Welcome to the Issue Is podcast for a new year. I'm Alex Michelson. Good to have you back as Omicron seems to be encroaching onto everybody in all places. This week, a conversation with Larry Elder, and a little bit later, we'll be talking with Alex Thompson from Politico about Omicron and the president and the vice president and January 6th and a lot more. But let's start with Larry, who, of course, became one of our most frequent guests and most talked about guests last year during the recall. This week, he announced that he is not going to be running for California governor. We talked to him about why. He was exceptionally candid in explaining his rationale not to. We talked about his new political action committee, which he just launched, called Elder for America, which if you look at the logo, looks just like Larry's running for president. We talked to him about the potential of running for president. I was kind of surprised on what he said there. Love him or hate him, Larry Elder is always interesting and always entertaining, and he did not disappoint in this interview. So here, back on The Issue is Larry Elder. Larry Elder, welcome back to The Issue Is. Are you running for president?
Alex, happy New Year. I like the way you get right to the point, don't you? Let's just remember how well we did. I was a candidate for all of 8 weeks. And in 8 weeks, we raised $22 million. We became the front runner right away. On the replacement side, we carried 57 of 58 counties in California. The only one we didn't carry was San Francisco, and we lost that by a whopping 149 votes, and we didn't spend one dime of advertising or 1 minute campaigning there. We got more votes, as you pointed out, than all of my rivals combined, including carrying San Diego County, where the two-term mayor of San Diego ran, and Sacramento, where a experienced politician, Kevin Kiley, also ran. So by any stretch of the imagination, we did extremely well. And we got about 150,000 individual donations. Almost half of those came outside of California. And that's one of the reasons, Alex, why I decided to set up this PAC, elderforamerica.com, because so many people with no ties whatsoever to the state know that so goes California, so goes the nation. And as you pointed out, we're going to try to help the Republicans take back the House, take back the Senate. We're going to campaign for school choice. We're going to campaign to get rid of some of these soft on crime DAs, campaign for common sense laws so that criminals serve the fullest extent of their crime that they commit. And we want to just make sure that the country continues moving in the right direction. I'm a realist. I know that in California, Democrats and independents who typically vote Democrat outnumber Republicans almost 3-1. So I'm not sure a rematch in the short term would make a whole lot of sense. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing, and I've set up elderforamerica.com.
Do you think that it is impossible right now for a Republican in California to win as California governor?
Right now, it would be extremely daunting. As you know, the issues were crime, the economy, the fact that people are leaving California for the first time, school choice, 75% of black boys cannot read at state levels of proficiency. People cite the high cost of living in California. The average price of a home in California costs 175% more than the average price of a home in America. Poor water management, poor fire management. We have energy brownouts. Yet still, when I talked about all these issues, all Gavin Newsom did was show a picture of Larry Elder side by side with Donald Trump, both of our thumbs up, and said, stop the Republican takeover. Obama cut a commercial, stop Republican takeover. Senator Warren, stop Republican takeover. Bernie Sanders, stop Republican takeover. Biden came in and said that I was more Trump than Trump or something like that. And it worked. It did not work in Virginia. It would not work in other states, but the electoral battlefield in California is daunting. It's not impossible. Possible, otherwise I wouldn't have tried it. But a recall election, Alex, is very different than a general one-to-one election. And I thought that with a plurality of the vote, I had a chance to become the next governor of California. In a mano-a-mano kind of race, given the electoral map as I just now outlined, I think would be extremely challenging.
So basically, you made the decision not to run because you didn't think you could win.
Boy, Alex, I love the way you summarize it. That's probably a good way of putting it. Not right now. The state has got to hit what I call rock bottom. And little by little, we're getting there. Crime has gone up since I ran. The homelessness problem has not been solved since I ran. Many people have watched the quality of education because they've been able to see how their kids were being taught because of the virtual learning. And a growing number of people now want school choice, which was a big issue that I campaigned for. But I don't think California is hit hit rock bottom quite yet, so that some of the Democrats and independents are going to rethink their allegiance to the Democratic Party. Well, at least not just yet.
Well, somebody's got to run for governor against Governor Newsom. Who do you want to see challenge him? Anybody that you would support or endorse as a candidate?
Virtually anybody but Newsom. I'm going to support whoever is the Republican challenger, Republican nominee. Virtually anybody but Newsom. As you know, he shut down this state. Now we're finding out more and more that there are all sorts of unintended consequences, rise in suicide, rise in homicide, rise in depression, rise in domestic violence, very likely rise in child abuse. I say very likely because since the schools were shut down, the number one reporting system of child abuse are the schools. So we just don't really know. And the economy hasn't gotten any better. The inflation is outrageous. And so I think that sooner or later, it's going to be somebody who's going to be able to take this man on, but it's going to require voters to stop their knee-jerk hostility towards Republican Party and knee-jerk hostility towards anybody who pulled the lever for Donald Trump. When I ran, as you know, people called me a Trump Republican. They didn't call me a Mitt Romney Republican. I voted for him. They didn't call me a John McCain Republican. I voted for him because Donald Trump in California is a four-letter word. I said during the campaign, the only person more hated than Donald Trump in California is Charlie Manson, and he's dead.
So do you think it needs to be a sort of never Trump Republican to win in this state?
Well, if you have a never-Trump Republican, you're probably not going to excite the Republican base. Look, Trump was the standard bearer. Did you want me to vote for Hillary? Did you want me to vote for Joe Biden? I don't understand why it is that people went nuts over the fact that I voted for Donald Trump. I'm not going to vote for somebody who's going to tax, spend, and regulate. And so I haven't voted for a Democrat since 1976, and that was Jimmy Carter, and I regret that.
So you're now focusing on the House and Senate, where Republicans do have a very good shot at winning. What is Elder for America? How does it work?
Well, it's a political action committee. I'm asking people to throw a little something in the tip jar to raise money so that I can campaign for and help support financially candidates, particularly those who are in tough districts, so that the Republicans can take back the House and take back the Senate. And also, as you know, a lot of stuff is happening at the school board level. We're having all of this nonsense about critical race theory. I want to do something to make sure that doesn't happen. And I want to support school choice so the money follows the child rather than the other way around. Half of all third graders in California cannot read at state levels of proficiency. It is absolutely outrageous. As you know, the Chicago Teachers Union just voted 72% not to go back to in-person education. I looked at the test scores for the Chicago kids before the pandemic. Only 34% of the of third graders in Chicago public school system could read at state levels. Now it's 18%, having lost a whole year of in-person education in 2020, and they want to do it again for 2022. It's outrageous. So I want to do something about that.
You know, we joked about the logo Elder for America and it looking like a presidential run, but is that something you might be interested in? Is there any part of you that is considering running for president?
Who knows what the future will bring? Larry Elder is only pawn in game of life. All I know is that in the near term, I'm not going to challenge Gavin Newsom in 2022. There won't be a rematch. I'm sure he's breathing a sigh of relief. But regarding that, I have no idea how my future holds. If the phone rings, I'm going to answer it.
I mean, that sounded like at least a maybe, which is usually a yes in politics.
I enjoyed campaigning far more than I thought I would. With all due respect, I think I was pretty good at it. I enjoy dealing with people, meeting people. I enjoy hearing about their issues. I miss radio far less than I thought I would. So I'm somebody who is interested in politics, interested in politicians, and I never was before. I never, ever thought that I would be the front runner. As you know, I was right away, mm-hmm. and my lead only got bigger and bigger. The last time I ran for office was third grade class president, and I carried 3 out of 4 roles. So for somebody who's the rookie, I did pretty well, and I really did enjoy it. So I'm not closing the door on what might happen down the road.
All right, well, let's talk about, you know, the policy right now as well. COVID continues to dominate the conversation. It did during the recall race. It continues now. We've got Omicron, a lot more people getting infected. Thankfully, a relatively small number of them needing to be hospitalized. What do you make of the COVID policies right now? And if you were in charge, how would things be different?
Well, if I were in charge, I would not have a mandate for vaccines. I would not have a mandate for masks. I would let individual municipalities and individual businesses determine what they want to do, which is what I said during the campaign, and I was called anti-vax. I've been vaccinated. I've had the boosters. I believe in vaccines, particularly for those in high-risk categories, and given my age and given an underlying blood condition I have, my doctor strongly recommended that I be vaccinated. But one of the things I said during the campaign is that young people are not likely to get sick, not likely to get real sick, not likely to be hospitalized, and certainly not likely to be to die. When I said that, CNN blasted me and said that I was wrong. Now a growing number of epidemiologists believe that closing down the state was a bad idea. Closing down schools was a bad idea. Even Joe Biden now says closing down schools is a bad idea. So a growing number of people, I believe, are coming around to the same idea that I had before, which is this is a very, very serious pandemic, but let's not make the cure worse than the disease. Let's not increase suicide. Let's not increase homicides. Let's not increase depression. Let's not increase opioid addiction. And these are the things that have happened as a result of the lockdowns and the mandates that this government, this governor has voiced it down the throats of Californians.
Although some might argue that the conditions on the ground have changed as well. A lot more people are vaccinated now. The disease itself has changed. Omicron, not as deadly as Delta was. And so maybe it's time for a policy shift because of that as well.
When you look at Florida and compare it to California, which state did better? When you look at Sweden and compare Sweden to the other countries in the Scandinavian area and in Europe, Sweden has done as well, if not better, than all those that imposed all of these draconian mandates. And their economy did not suffer as a result of it. Much of the businesses that have closed down here in California were owned by black and brown people, the kinds of people that the people on the left claim that they care about. These are the kinds of things that should have been taken into consideration, but weren't.
Although the death per 100,000 number in California versus Florida is lower, but we're not going to get into a whole COVID debate. Let's talk more about you. How did the recall change you? Because you're such a big radio star. You go through this massive sort of explosion of attention. Then you take a little break, go back to the radio. Where are you at now, mindset-wise? Are you a changed person? Does it feel like I'm just back to doing what I was doing before?
No, I'm changed forever. Once you do something like this and go through something like this, it changes you forever. It was the most grueling thing I ever did. These were 18-hour days, and virtually every one of my press conferences you showed up at, so you know how hard I worked and how hard you worked in covering me. It made me more connected. It made me believe in America even more. As unhappy as I was with the outcome of the election, so many people came up to me crying, telling me that if you win, I'll stay. If you lose, I'm going to leave. And I think that we ignited things all across the country, including, I think, it informed the race in Virginia. They drew the wrong lesson in Virginia. Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate, assumed all you had to do was say Trump, 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 Trump. And in Virginia, unlike California, there was a debate between the two candidates. And Glenn Youngkin and the Republicans said about 20 minutes into the debate something to the effect of, we've been debating now for 20 minutes, and you've mentioned Donald Trump five times. That did not work in Virginia. I also think we exposed the media for how unfair they are. As you know, the LA Times columnists called me the black face of white supremacy. My goodness, that outraged even people on the left. So I think a lot of people have taken a fresh look at how unfair the media are, and I think we shed a lot of light on that. So I'm very proud of some of the issues that we raised.
And now, who knows, the big takeaway for me on this, maybe Larry for president. That's what I'm hearing from what you said.
Well, again, I'm reminded of what Walter Cronkite once said when people wanted him to run for office. He said, I love to be a senator. I hate to have to run. So if you can figure out some sort of way of appointing me president, again, I will not refuse to take the phone call. But right now, I want people just to go to my website, elderforamerica.com, throw a little something in the tip jar, and let's retake the House, retake the Senate. Let's campaign for school choice. Let's get rid of some of these soft on crime DAs and make sure that criminals are punished for the crimes that they commit.
Our thanks to Larry Elder. Now to Alex Thompson, who is a graduate of my high school, Agora High School, and has become a really prominent and successful White House correspondent for Politico. He writes the West Wing Playbook, which you can subscribe to for free. He's also in the process of writing a book about Joe Biden. And he's in the briefing room sort of in the middle of it every day with interesting insights into what's happening. We talk about January 6th. We talk about Joe Manchin. We talk about Kamala Harris. But let's begin with COVID. And right before we recorded this, Alex Thompson figured out that he's COVID positive. Grateful he still did it. Here's Alex with his COVID.
Alex, welcome to The Issue Is and go Agoura Chargers.
That's right. And don't, I'm at least the second best journalist after you to come out of Agoura.
Oh, okay. All right. Enough of that. All right. Well, let's start though with the big issue of the week, which is COVID. And COVID got personal for you.
Yeah, I am positive for COVID as of this morning. So, and you know, I was also invited even on MSNBC later, but I said no. But I was never going to cancel on you, Alex, and my, you know, obviously the LA station where I'm from.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we appreciate you sticking with us. Let's talk. And glad you're feeling okay and feeling up to doing this. But let's talk though broadly about the issue of COVID. Clearly, you were able to get a test to know that you're now COVID positive. But there's a lot of folks that are struggling to get tests. Back in December, President Biden promised that he would have 500 million tests start going out in January. That hasn't happened yet. Is this an example of the president over-promising and under-delivering?
Well, this has been a huge failure, and it really is the result of not what Biden did in December. You know, trying to get 500 million tests and then having them mailed out within a month is an incredible logistical challenge. Really, the failure comes from last July and last summer when, you know, the Biden administration really put all their eggs in the vaccine basket. And they basically thought they were on their way to getting out of this. You know, they had that big party on the White House lawn on Independence Day, you know, independence from the virus. So, you know, they sort of took their foot off the gas when it came to testing and when it came to masks. So right now we have a situation where lots of people are still wearing cloth masks, which are not nearly as effective against Omicron, and the testing shortages are everywhere. Yes, I got a test, but that was also because I stood in line with 400 people outside a library the other day while I probably had COVID and perhaps even infected some people. So, you know, we're looking at potentially some of these tests going out as soon as late next week. But even then, you're not even going to get close to the 500 million mark, probably at least until February, if not much later.
It seems like there's a lot of blame being shifted behind the scenes, including a lot at CDC Director Rochelle Walensky.
Absolutely. What you've seen over and over again is the Biden administration, you know, they came in sort of with this idealistic idea of, you know, we're just going to follow the science and not let it get political. But when you're making public policy on a science issue, everything is inherently political. And so what you've seen is CDC Director Rochelle Walensky has made these decisions in her mind following the science, but some of these decisions don't comport with what the Biden administration wants. And some of the Biden administration scientists, in particular, Dr. Fauci, disagree with some of her decisions. And so what you've increasingly seen is what was at first whispers and frustrations over the first few months are starting to come out into view, where a lot of Biden people are you know, talking to reporters like myself and like people at the New York Times on background and anonymously and sort of pointing out some missteps that Rochelle Walensky has made. And, you know, you haven't seen her back down. She decided to do her first press briefing just yesterday, sort of to show that she's going to keep on doing this. But I would expect this to be a really interesting relationship and tension point over the next 6 months.
Meanwhile, another big story this week is January 6th, the anniversary. And we heard a more aggressive tone than ever from President Biden towards former President Donald Trump during that speech. Is this going to be a new trend? Is that what your White House sources are talking about?
You know, I don't think so. I think a lot of Democrats would like that. But, you know, Biden has really resisted his entire first year talking, you know, using the T word. You know, we've almost become like a he who must not be named figure inside the White House. Even yesterday, it was an incredibly aggressive message toward Trump. But you notice he actually never said the word. I think he said the word words former president something like 16 a dozen times. And, you know, I think a lot of Democrats were hardened. But I can tell you a lot of White House people were doing sort of a cleanup and tampering down expectations yesterday after it seemed that maybe this was like some sort of pivot point.
You know, a lot of folks on the left say a way to prevent another January 6th is to actually pass voting rights legislation, which hasn't happened so far. Democratic Senators Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema have been unwilling to change the Senate rules so Democrats could pass this on their own. This week, I spoke with California Congressman Adam Schiff and also Maxine Waters, and they expressed some of their frustration. Take a look.
We're being held up by Manchin and by Sinema. We know that, and the world knows that, and we need to say it over and over again.
I am surprised. I'm dismayed. I'm frustrated, and I'm frightened about what that means for our democracy.
So this Joe Biden-Joe Manchin relationship could really be the key not only to voting rights, but also to social spending, really the president's entire agenda. So what's the deal? What's happening between the two Joes right now?
Well, I can tell you that relationships are not good between the two Joes. You saw there was this huge dust up in December when Joe Manchin honestly caught a lot of the White House off guard when he went on a Fox News Sunday and basically said, I'm not going to vote for this bill. And I can tell you that Joe Biden tried to get Joe Manchin on the phone before he did that interview and could not get through. Now, when you're the president and someone's not taking your calls and then it leaks that they're not taking your calls, you know, it's a pretty embarrassing, humiliating gesture. Now, since then, there's been sort of a little bit of a standoff of who's going to call who first. And so you've seen some talk on the lower levels. But the Joe and Joe relationship is not good, which, you know, to your bigger point of what does this mean for voting rights? I can tell you that the expectations for a big comprehensive voting rights bill that Democrats have been advocating, that Maxine Waters and Adam Schiff are advocating for, is extremely unlikely. Now, the White House has enlisted a lot of allies, including everyone from Oprah to Bill Clinton, to call Joe Manchin to try to sway him. But all indications I've had so far are that Joe Manchin is not going to do a voting rights bill unless it has Republican support. And right now, that doesn't look like that's going to happen.
So just to be clear, Joe Manchin took Oprah's call, but not Joe Biden's call?
That's a really pithy way of saying it. But yes, that did happen.
Yeah, that's sort of the state of the world, right? Alex is sticking with us. We're back with Alex Thompson of Politico. Alex, what happened with Jamal Simmons?
Yeah, it's never a good sign when you have to apologize on your first day. He basically sent a tweet in around 2010, which talked about how he had seen two undocumented people on TV and asked why ICE was not picking them up. Obviously this was pointed out, it was from 2010, but it did seem to catch the vice president's office and the White House off guard, which was surprising if he had some controversial tweets. As you may remember, lots of people in the administration have already had their nominations and hirings frustrated by old bad tweets. And so he posted a statement, sent a statement to me apologizing. He then did another clarifying tweet. And also you're seeing a sort of slow motion reset in that office. A lot of people are leaving or are on their way out, and a lot of new people are being hired.
So you're in there day in, day out, talking to these folks. I mean, take us in the room. Like, what's really going on there?
You know, I think if they're going to be honest, they would say, like, it was not a good first year. And I think, all throughout the White House, not just the VP's office, I think there's been, they're sort of demoralized. It's been a frustrating year. I think the first 6 months, I think people thought it was going well. And then the rug started, starting with Delta and then Afghanistan, and it started getting much worse. In terms of Vice President Harris's office, they brought in a few new people to try to fix things, and you're starting to see them shift strategies. You're starting to see them do a lot more interviews, try to be more accessible, but they do feel that they feel a little bit like the White House hasn't always supported them. And so that frustration has been, that relationship has also been a little bit tense, which is why you saw her get so involved in the student loan moratorium debate so recently, is because, it was an easy policy win for her and the White House wanted to give that to her.
What's the relationship like between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris? And what's the relationship like between their staffs?
That's such an important distinction, Alex, because between Harris herself and Biden, everything that I've heard from my sources say it's quite good. And honestly, the real reason for that is because of Beau Biden. Beau Biden was, Joe's late son who died of cancer. But before he died, he and Harris were very close friends. And if you're Joe Biden, there's no one's opinion or validation he sought more than Beau Biden's. Now, the staff is a whole different issue. The staffs have not really liked each other. It's not universal, but there has definitely been a lot more contention, a lot more frustration, a lot more passive aggressive, lack of communicating, and between the two staffs. And I can even tell you, inside the West Wing, it's sort of openly talked about as Pete as the successor rather than Harris. Now, not all parts of the West Wing, but the fact that even parts of the West Wing so openly discuss a transportation secretary over the vice president shows that, things are not necessarily in the best place.
When he says Pete, he means Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation who ran last time and will be joining us next week here on The Issue Is. All right, before we let you go, we like to play a game called Personal Issues. This is to get to know our guests a little bit better. We put 30 seconds on the clock, rapid fire questions. This is where we have some fun. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. What is your favorite TV show?
Succession.
What's your favorite band of all time?
Red Hot Chili Peppers, Keep It SoCal.
What's your all-time favorite book?
Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien.
Best vacation spot?
Hawaii.
Who is the all-time best Agora High School student body president?
Oh, that's Alex Michelson.
There we go. Ding! You got that one. Politico endorsed. That's something else.
All right,
Alex, it is great to have you with us. Our thanks to Alex Thompson, and our thanks to you for listening. By the way, if you're a podcast fan, you may want to check out the Culture Pop podcast. This week, their guest was me. I was on with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske, had a really interesting conversation there and enjoyed what they did and grateful that they invited me on. Hope you'll be with us next week. We expect to have Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation. Looking forward to that conversation. In the meantime, have a good one. Like, review us, rate us, reach out in social media, and see you next time for more The Issue Is.